We are moving towards the home stretch in my description of Father Teilhard de Chardin's theistic view of the theory of evolution that is based upon intelligent design. Father Chardin proposed that there were three levels of evolution: the chemical, organic, mental, and a fourth, the spiritual, that was yet to come. Each level went as far as it could go in terms of complexification, and then at a certain point, which he called complexification and centricity, it leapt qualitatively over into the next higher level. Thus, non-living chemicals, when they reached the level of inorganic compounds, became organic compounds that took on the qualities of life, such as growth, reproduction, sensation, and self-movement. This next level, the organic or life level, then proceeds to follow the same path of complexification as simple one-cell creatures evolved into multi-cell creatures, which then, through the law of organization and specialization, began to move from the stem cell stage, where all cells were identical in appearance and function, to the organ stage, where each started to take on a specialized function such as heart, liver, pancreas, eyes, ears, etc. From this point on, the various species of living beings evolved into higher forms of life by incorporating previous steps with newer adaptations. How, or even if this happened, no one knows, because although microevolution, that is, evolution within the species, in which various types of dogs evolved from one prototype, is a fact, macroevolution, that is, evolution between species, in which a hippopotamus becomes a horse, is still very much a theory with little or no evidence to support it. When and if this is even proven should have no significant impact on our Christian view, because it will merely describe the how and still leave unanswered the question of who and why. No matter how much the atheistic supporters of the theory of evolution try to present it as a totally accidental phenomena, they are still stuck with the problem of why does a totally accidental process seem to follow laws that move it towards higher and more complex forms, and who created the laws? Based on the evidence, evolution is directional as it moves from a simple hydrogen atom to complex beings such as ourselves. Even if one could believe that non-conscious atoms could accidentally form a human body, why should they then stabilize into a form that is capable of reproducing itself? And how is it possible that the same non-conscious atoms accidentally form both a female-male version of the same species who accidentally possessed all the intricate equipment necessary for reproduction? The atheistic evolutionists are confronted with so many impossible questions to answer that one can only conclude that their commitment to an atheistic answer is based on philosophy rather than science. Their faith in an accidental universe, because that is exactly what it is, dwarfs the faith of those who believe in intelligent design. And how, one might ask, does an accidental universe, which lacks any intelligence, produce a third level of evolution, the mental or cultural level, that contains human beings who possess a rational mind? One of the principles of logic is, all effects must be proportionate to their causes. In other words, you can't give what you don't have. To produce intelligence, the universe must contain intelligence, and that is why the ancient Hebrews believed that human beings were made in the image and likeness of the Creator. How, they wondered, was it possible for a creature to have intelligence if the source of the universe lacked it? Some atheistic evolutionists think that they have solved their problem by saying that it is possible for an accidental process to create intelligent results if a selecting agent is added. For example, is it possible for a chimpanzee to produce a Shakespearean play if he keeps pounding the keyboard of a computer for a billion years? Their answer is yes, if there is a selecting agent who could pick out from the mass of accidental letters the ones needed to form the words of the play. In other words, if there was a natural selector that would determine the survival of the fittest, which in this case would be the text of the play. This, of course, solves nothing for them because the natural selector indicates an intelligence that is selecting towards a rational end. I have already indicated that, from a Christian perspective, the natural selector is the logos or logic of God, who, according to St. John, is Jesus. Thus, no matter how you spin it, an evolutionary process that is moving directionally towards higher forms of life suggests intelligent design. And now, according to Father Chardin, we have reached the mental or third level of evolution, and through the law of complexification are moving rapidly towards the point where, based on the previous levels, we should go through a qualitative leap onto the next level. In other words, we are headed towards the omega point which is the spiritual level where mankind will discover fire for the second time. The first time was physical fire that released the energy that powered civilization. The second time, he says, will be the fire of love, which will usher in the fulfillment of the prophecies in the Old Testament that foretold of a time when men will take the weapons of war and beat them into tools for farming, and the lion, symbolic of violence and force, will lie down with the lamb, symbolic of peace and cooperation, and justice and peace will kiss. In other words, the human race will finally break free of its animal roots based on dominance and territorial defense and come to realize that we all belong to the brotherhood of man under the fathership of God. This, of course, has always been the vision of the Judeo-Christian linear utopian concept of history, but it is also the vision of the secular humanists who led the French Revolution and the communist revolutions that followed. Their motto was liberty, fraternity, and equality. And thus we are faced with two competing visions of what the final conclusion of history should be. The problem is that they both sound very similar in ends, but they differ immensely in means. And that is why many liberally minded Christians are pulled into the secular humanist camp by their counterfeit version of the kingdom of God. The basic difference between the two visions has to do with freedom. And both visions speak of it, but they have different interpretations of what it means. Both the Judeo-Christian and secular humanist visions speak of a time when we will be free of war, poverty, disease, crime, and all the other ills that plague mankind. To the humanist, the ends justify the means, while the churches are committed to moral means to reach moral ends. Thus, humanistic forces will eliminate the problems of mankind by creating a super welfare state that will eliminate the people that are identified with the problems through abortion, euthanasia, genetic engineering, human experimentation, behavior modification, and whatever techniques that science and technology provide. One famous secular humanist, B.F. Skinner, Harvard professor and psychologist, epitomizes this view in his book, Beyond Freedom and Dignity, where he takes a mechanistic view of human beings who can be manipulated to serve whatever ends those in charge desire. Freedom and free will, he says, are an illusion because we are all products of our environments, and thus who or what we are is determined by the environment to which we are exposed. Skinner, in accordance with his own theory, placed his daughter during her infancy in a Skinner box, a glass-walled room in which all environmental conditions were controlled by him. In this way, he intended to shape her to his specifications. Other well-intended humanists would like to do the same to the rest of us. Another famous secular humanist, Dr. Jack Kevorkian, who is now in jail because of his involvement in assisted suicide, once proposed on a talk radio program that criminals who had been sentenced to death should be used for medical experimentation that would end in their death. Why, he argues, should we not get some practical benefit from their death? Here we see the philosophy of pragmatism taken to its logical conclusion. And, of course, all these things were done before by Adolf Hitler's Nazi regime that wanted to create a master race by the elimination of inferior types and the propagation of Aryan types through a genetic breeding program. It amazes me that Jewish secular humanists fail to recognize the premises of the Holocaust in many of the programs they support. All this suggests that we should beware of utopian-minded people who do not accept or recognize any higher moral law that constrains the methods that they use. In other words, beware of atheists who want to lead us to the promised land. Since they recognize no power or law greater than their own, there is nothing to limit the methods that they use, and eventually their methods result in the dehumanization of other human beings. The Church, on the other hand, wishes to address the same problems through a principle of subsidiarity that challenges all of us to accept personal responsibility for their solution on whatever level is feasible. Now let me return to Aldous Huxley's Brave New World. As I ended my last program, I was describing Aldous Huxley's book Brave New World that demonstrated what could happen when utopian-minded leaders were free to use science and technology to eliminate the problems created by human freedom. When I ended my program, we had already heard 1. That babies were created through in vitro fertilization from eggs that were harvested from females and sperm from males. Impregnation took place in a soup-like mixture, and each egg was microscopically inspected to see that it came up to the quality control standards set by the leaders. Those that didn't were discarded. 2. The fertilized eggs were placed in bottles that were lined with uteruses taken from pigs. This is reminiscent of a radio program that I heard in which two female doctors were arguing about the effectiveness of testing new drugs on human embryos. One pointed to a study conducted in California as proof of the effectiveness of this, while the other protested the results because the fertilized human embryos had been placed in the wombs of female rats who were then injected with the drug to be tested. Thus, without objecting to the method used, she argued that the inclusion of the rat in the experiment tainted the results. I wonder how the mothers of those embryonic children would feel if they knew that they were placed in the uterus of female rats. 3. While on its 9-month trip on the conveyor belt, the embryos in the bottle were subjected to Pavlovian conditioning designed to shape their minds to accept the conditions that the leader had predestined them to assume. Thus, those destined to work in the tropics were alternately sent through tunnels that were hot and cold. While in the cold tunnels, they were subjected to X-rays that caused them discomfort. As a result, they developed an inherent aversion to the cold and an affinity for the heat. 4. Each developing child was assigned one of the 5 social classes in Brave New World. The alphas and betas were predestined to become leaders, while the deltas, epsilons, and gammas were predestined to serve the more menial jobs. And each, through the manipulation of the oxygen going to their brains during their gestation period, were given an IQ that was most compatible with their assigned role in life. 5. Upon decanting the word they used for birth, each child was dressed according to its class, and then through sleep-teaching methods and neo-Pavlovian conditioning, mentally and emotionally shaped to fit the role that the state had assigned them. Although we might find it hard to believe that anyone would use these methods in the shaping of children, Pavlovian condition was used in the Soviet Union under communism in an attempt to shape children who wouldn't cry, and thus as adults, wouldn't complain. 6. As I ended my last program, I had just finished describing how Pavlovian conditioning was used to teach children to hate books and flowers, but to love to go to the country. You might remember that the director explained to the students that this was done to instill in them a love for the country, but a hatred for flowers, because while their love for the country kept transportation workers employed, their love of flowers did not. Therefore, they were taught to love country sports that required the purchase of expensive equipment. This, I pointed out, refers to one of the basic flaws in capitalism, that because it has tied production and distribution together, can't stop one without stopping the other. We are on an eternal treadmill of producing economic goods, whether we need them or not, because if we ever stopped, we would have no other way for people to earn the income they need to buy them. However, Brave New World did not stop with the use of electric shock to implant in the minds a distaste for flowers based on negative reinforcement. They also used positive reinforcement through sleep teaching to motivate people to desire those things that the state wanted them to desire. This tool was discovered in the period preceding Brave New World when the parents of Ruben Rabinovich accidentally left the radio on in his room overnight. The director explains, quote, "While the child was asleep, a radio broadcast program from London suddenly started to come through, and the next morning, to the astonishment of his parents, he repeated word for word the program. The principle of sleep teaching had been discovered, but many years would have passed before the principle was applied usefully. The case of little Reuben occurred only 23 years after our Ford's first T model was put on the market. Here the director made the sign of the T, and all the students reverently followed his example. And yet these early experiments were on the wrong track. They thought that sleep teaching could be used to teach facts, whereas it was far more effective in moral education, which shapes attitudes. Moral education, which ought never in any circumstance to be rational, that is, based on facts rather than feelings." End of quote. Thus, as part of the brainwashing program designed to shape the children as willing slaves of the states, they were subjected to hours of suggestions and slogans that were repeated through speakers under their pillows while they slept. The director led the students to the nurseries upstairs, where a sleep teaching lesson was taking place. Huxley writes, quote, "Just then they approached the dormitories where young children were kept. A nurse rose as they entered and came to attention before the director. 'What's the lesson this afternoon?' he asked. 'We had elementary sex for the first 40 minutes,' she answered, 'but now it's switched to class identity and acceptance.' The director walked slowly down the aisle between the beds in which small children of beta class lay sleeping. The tape-recorded voice of a sleep-teaching lesson could be heard coming from beneath the pillows. The director halted, and bending over one of the little beds, listened attentively. At the end of the room, a loudspeaker projected from the wall. The director walked up to it and pressed the switch. Alpha children wear gray. They work much harder than we do because they're so very clever. I'm really awfully glad I'm a beta because I don't work as hard. And then we are much better than the gammas and deltas. Gammas are stupid. They all wear green. And delta children wear khaki. Oh, no. I don't want to play with delta children, and epsilons are still worse. They're too stupid to be able to read or write. Besides, they wear blue, which is such a beastly color. I'm so glad I'm a beta. Alpha children wear gray, etc. End of quote. Then the director said, they'll have that repeated 40 or 50 times more before they wait. Then again on Thursday and again on Saturday. 120 times, 3 times a week for 30 months. The greatest moralizing and socializing force of all time. Like drops of water wearing away a hard stone till at last the child's mind is these suggestions, and the sum of the suggestions is the child's mind. And not the child's mind only, the adult's mind too, all his life long. The mind that judges and desires and decides, made up of these suggestions. But all of these suggestions are our suggestions. The director almost shouted in triumph. Suggestions from the state. He banged the nearest table. It therefore follows. A noise made him turn around. Oh, Ford, I've gone and awakened the children. End the quote. It is interesting to note that the leaders of Brave New World realize that slogans repeated over and over again are far more effective in shaping values than our rational explanations based on facts. Consider, for example, the repetition of slogans like different strokes for different folks or just do it. These slogans and suggestions are directed at the right lobe of the brain, which, because it doesn't censor and is suggestible, takes them in without any critical evaluation. Later in the book, we are told that some of the suggestions implanted into the minds of their children are, ending is better than mending, ending is better than mending, and the less stitches, the more riches, the less stitches, the more riches, which were designed to keep consumer purchasing at a high level in order to keep the factories and their workers going. Once these suggestions were firmly implanted in the minds of the children, they would become part of the throwaway society that was necessary to solve the basic flaw in capitalism. Of course, nothing like this could ever happen. No one could ever create a culture in which people were taught and motivated to throw things away rather than repair them in order to keep people working. Why, if people ever did that, there would be a horrendous trash problem that would eventually deplete natural resources and pollute the earth. You might wonder how, according to Huxley, Brave New World came about. As the students are finishing their tour of the hatcheries where babies are created, it is announced that one of the 10 world controllers, Mustafa Mann, has arrived and he is going to address the students. The book continues, quote, His Fordship, Mustafa Mann, the eyes of the saluting students almost popped out of their heads. Mustafa Mann, the resident controller for Western Europe, one of the 10 world controllers, and he sat down on the bench with the director. He was going to stay, yes, and actually talk to them, straight from the horse's mouth, straight from the mouth of Ford himself. You all remember, said the controller in his strong, deep voice, you all remember, I suppose, that beautiful and inspired saying of our Fords, history is bunk. That's why you're taught no history. But now the time has come. The director looked at him nervously. There were those strange rumors of old forbidden books hidden in the safe in the controller's study. Bibles, poetry, Ford knew what. It's all right, Director Mustafa Mann said. I won't corrupt them. Mustafa Mann leaned forward, shook a finger at them. Just try to realize it, he said. Try to realize what it was like to have a natural mother. That dirty word again, but none of them dreamed this time of smiling. Try to imagine what with one's family meant. And do you know what home was? They shook their head. Home, home. A few small rooms, stuffy, overcrowded. No air, a space, an under-sterilized prison. Darkness, disease, and smells. His description was so vivid that one of the students got sick. It was a rabbit hole, reeking with emotion. R. Ford, or R. Freud, as for some unknown reason he chose to call himself whenever he spoke on psychoanalytic matters, had been the first to reveal the awful dangers of family life in his Oedipus complex. The world was full of fathers, was therefore full of misery, full of mothers, therefore of every kind of perversion from sadism to chastity, full of brothers, sisters, uncles, and aunts, full of madness and suicide. And there was also husbands, wives, and lovers. There was monogamy with one husband or wife and romance. Though you probably don't know what those are, said Mustafa Mann. They shook their heads. Family, monogamy, romance, everywhere exclusiveness, a narrow channeling of energy and impulse. but everyone belongs to everyone else, he concluded, repeating the sleep teaching proverb. The students nodded, emphatically agreeing with statements that upwards of 62,000 repetitions in the dark had made them accept, not merely as true, but as axiomatic, self-evident, utterly indisputable. No wonder these poor pre-moderns were mad, wicked, and miserable. Their world didn't allow them to take things easily without a struggle, didn't allow them to be sane, virtuous, happy. What with mothers and lovers, what with the moral laws they were not conditioned to obey, what with the temptations, what with the uncertainties and the poverty, they were forced to feel strongly. And feeling strongly, how could they be stable? Stability, said the controller, stability. No civilization without social stability. No social stability without individual stability. Fortunate boys, said the controller, no pains have been spared to make your lives emotionally easy, to preserve you as far as possible from having emotions at all. Consider your own lives, said Mustafa Man. Has any of you ever had any difficult problem? I once had to wait nearly 4 weeks before a girl I wanted would let me have her, a young student said. And you felt a strong emotion as a result? Horrible, said the student. Horrible, exactly, said the controller. Our ancestors were so stupid and short-sighted that when the first reformers came along and offered to deliver them from those horrible emotions, they wouldn't have anything to do with them. Take the hatcheries. Would the government look at it? No. There was something called Christianity. Women were forced to have their own children. Sleep teaching was actually forbidden in England. The record survives. Speech is about liberty of the individual, liberty to be inefficient and miserable, freedom to be a round peg in a square hole. They resisted the caste system. Every time it was suggested, it was rejected. There was something called democracy, as though men were more than physiochemical equals. Here Huxley is referring to B.F. Skinner's observation about humans. Then came the 9 Years' War, the great economic collapse. There was a choice between world control and destruction. Note here, Will Durant, the historian, said, when freedom destroys order, the need for order will destroy freedom. Government's an affair of sitting, not hitting. You rule with the brains and buttocks, never with the fists. For example, there was a law requiring consumption. Every loyal citizen was required to buy as much as he could. There was conscientious objection on a large scale. They did anything not to consume. There was a movement back to nature, back to culture. Yes, actually to culture. You can't consume much if you sit still and read. In the nurseries on the floor above them, the elementary class consciousness lesson was over, and the voice of the tape recorder was adapting future demand to industrial supply. I do love flying, the tape whispered. I do love flying. I do love having clothes. I do love clothes. But old clothes are awful, continued the untiring whisper. We always throw away old clothes. Ending is better than mending. Ending is better than mending. The more stitches, the less riches. The more stitches, the less riches. I do love flying. I do love flying. The controller continued. 800 simple lifers, people wanting to go back to nature, were mowed down by machine guns. Then came the famous British Museum massacre. 2,000 cultural fans gassed with poison gas. In the end, said Mustafa Man, the controllers realized that force was no good. The slow but sure method of artificial birth, Pavlovian conditioning, and sleep teaching were introduced. Then there were the blowing up of the historical monuments and the suppression of all books published before AF 150. AF stands for After Fort. There were books like the Bible and Shakespeare. You never heard of them, of course. Such are the advantages of a really scientific education. Then came the introduction of our Ford's first T model, which was chosen as the opening date of the new era. There was a thing, as I said before, called Christianity. It was the ethics and philosophy of underconsumption, for example, Mother Teresa of Calcutta. It was necessary when there was underproduction, but in the age of machines it was positively a crime against society. All crosses had their tops cut off and became T's. There was also a thing called God, but we have the world state now, and Ford's Day celebration, and community sings, and solidarity services. There was a thing called a soul, and a thing called immortality. But the people used to take morphine, cocaine, and heroin. 2,000 pharmacists were paid by the government in AF 178 to find a perfect drug. 6 years later, it was being introduced commercially. All the advantages of Christianity and alcohol, none of the defects. Take a holiday from reality whenever you like and come back without so much as a headache. It only remained to conquer old age. Today at 60, our powers and tastes are what they were at 17. Old men in the bad old days used to retire, take to religion, spend their time reading, thinking. Note, The word amusement means without thought, and Gehenna, the Old Testament word for hell, means empty thought. Now, such is progress that the old work. The old men have sex. The old men have no time. No rest from pleasure. Not a moment to sit down and think. And if by some chance they should find some time to think and worry, there is always soma pills, or happiness pills. A gram is better than a dam, he said, repeating the sleep-teaching slogan that had been programmed into their heads with over 2,000 repetitions. A gram for a weekend, 2 grams for a longer trip. Go away, little girl, shouted the director angrily. Go away, little boy. Can't you see his fordship is busy? Go and do your erotic sexual play somewhere else. Suffer the little children to come unto me, said the controller. Obviously, this is a takeoff on a scene in the New Testament of the Bible where Jesus' apostles are shooing children away and he reprimands them with the same words. It should be clear that Huxley meant Brave New World to be a description of an antichrist society that would enslave people through a process called soft slavery. But how serious is Huxley about the possible reality of Brave New World? In 1958, he wrote that the 21st century would be the era of world controllers who would establish a scientific and technological dictatorship that would never end because, quote, the older dictators fell because they could never supply their subjects with enough bread, enough circuses, enough miracles and mysteries. Under a scientific dictatorship, education will really work, with the results that most men and women will grow up to love their servitude and will never dream of revolution. There seems to be no good reason why a thoroughly scientific dictatorship should ever be overthrown. End of quote. In his book Brave New World Revisit, one of Huxley's characters quotes from a work by the Russian writer Dostoevsky. He says, quote, in the end, they, the people, will lay their freedom at our feet and say to us, make us your slaves, but feed us. This is the basic flaw in the secular humanist position. They believe that man can live by bread alone, and that if you provide for his physical needs, it will be enough to make him happy. St. Paul says that the gospel message is the message of the cross, which seems foolish to those who are perishing. Hegel says that the law of life is struggle, and without antitheses we are incapable of developing. Brave New World is an antichrist society that has dedicated itself to removing all antitheses and crosses from its people's lives, and in the process they have prevented them from moving from what Erich Fromm calls a destructive relationship based on dependency to a productive one based on freedom and love. That is why the Church supports the principle of subsidiarity, because it requires that each of us accept the responsibility for our own lives to the degree that we are capable. The problems and crosses of life are there to help us grow, and only those who face the crucifixion will experience the resurrection. Thus, to be truly free and to experience the fullness of life, we have to move from other control to self-control. E-V-I-L is L-I-V-E spelled backwards, and it suggests that everything that is anti-life is evil. If this is so, then Brave New World epitomizes evil. Well, I see that my time is up. Here's Dom.